There's a famous story in the Talmud about the non-Jew that came to Hillel and Shammai and asked them both, teach me the whole Torah on one foot. Shammai chased the person away. Hillel, however, gave the person a very brief answer. If you want to know the whole Torah on one foot, we can basically say what is harmful to you, do not do unto another, and the rest is commentary. And go and spend your life learning the commentary. To some degree, that's exactly the question that I face today. How does one summarize the entire system in one epigram? And not being as talented as Hillel, I'm not able to do it. But as Pirkei Avot says, Ethics of the Fathers teaches us, Lo alecha hamlacha ligmor, it is not upon you to finish the task. Ve'i ata ben chorin lihibatel mimenu, but you are not free to abdicate your responsibility to at least start it. In discussing the notion of Jewish law, I think there are a few preliminary points I'd like to make. If you read the Bible today, and regretfully very few people do read the Bible, particularly the five books of Moses, most of us read the Bible for its stories, for its narratives, the story of creation, the story of Noah and the flood, the story of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and the saga of Joseph. However, to the Jewish mind, the primary function of the Bible was not a book of narrative or a book of history, but was actually a book of law, a book of directive, a book in which God instructs us how we are supposed to live our lives. The notion that the essence of the Bible, the Torah, was law, was so well grounded within the Jewish mind that Rashi, the great commentary, actually raises a question. Why does the Torah begin with the story of the creation of the world, which after all is not a mitzvah, is not a commandment? And if you start reading the laws of the Bible, and under our tradition there are 613, 248 positive commandments, thou shalt do, and 365 negative commandments, thou shalt not do, you immediately recognize that there is no dichotomy at all in the biblical and the halakhic system between law and religion. Most people understand law to refer to interpersonal obligations such as contracts, torts, property rights, and religion is normally relegated to the ritualistic or worshipful realm of life, church and synagogue services. But if you open the Torah almost at random, in the book of Exodus or the book of Leviticus, you will see side by side with such ritualistic laws as observance of the Shabbats and not cooking meat and milk, you will find laws regarding theft, payment of wages, not lying, telling the truth in the judicial process. And one might actually say, well, gee, those are religious laws and these are interpersonal laws, and why are they combined? Wouldn't an astute editor separate them into discrete categories? But that's exactly the point, that in Jewish understanding, there is no dichotomy between law, which is called in Hebrew, Bein Adam L'Chaveiro, the interpersonal relationship, and the purely religious or ritualistic, which is referred to by the term Bein Adam L'Makom, between man and God. Because in reality, even the interpersonal laws are expressions of God's will as to how we have to live our lives and create our societies. And therefore, point number one is there is no dichotomy between the so-called legal spheres of life and the so-called religious or ritualistic spheres of life. A corollary of this is that in an ideal Jewish state, there would in fact be no separation of church and state. In fact, the Torah envisions a government that would be predicated on the religious laws of the Torah. Now, that's not to say that there might be some factors of separation of church and state that even biblical Judaism would recognize. For example, there is a law that Kohanim, members of the priestly class, are not supposed to have political office. And Nachmanides explains that this is because we don't want there to be an intermingling between clerical functions and governmental functions. But even there, it is not because we want the state to be protected from the pernicious influence of religion, but it's exactly the opposite. We don't want religious values to be compromised by the political deal-making and the like that can often corrupt disinterested moral judgments. But be it as it may, I think point number one is that religion in the biblical and later Talmudic sense encompasses every single activity of life, that there is a Jewish law of contracts, of torts, of partnership, of inheritance, just as there is a Jewish law of Shabbat, the holidays, the laws of keeping kosher and the like. All of them are our obligation to try to do the will of God as expressed in the Torah and in the halachic tradition. In fact, the very word halacha, which is often a synonym for Jewish law, means the path, the way that one walks in this world to live a life in accordance with the will of God. A second point that needs to be stressed is that ultimately there is no dichotomy between the values of law and the fundamental principles of ethics and morality. And this is an important point. They tell a famous story about one of the great justices on the American Supreme Court, Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, who was once taking a cab ride with another famous judge who did not quite make the Supreme Court, although many felt he should have, Judge Learned Hand. And as they separated when they reached the Supreme Court building, Learned Hand turned to Oliver Wendell Holmes and said, Justice Holmes, do justice today. And Justice Holmes turned to Judge Learned Hand and said, my job is not to do justice. My job is to administer the law, whether it is just or not. And indeed, in Justice Holmes' writings, he draws a consistent distinction between moral obligations and legal obligations. And in fact, in a famous essay in his classic book, The Common Law, he once posited that when we view the law of contract from the perspective of a secular system, we have to understand it by looking at it through the eyes of a bad man. Basically, the lawyers in the audience certainly know that generally speaking, if I make a contract to do something and I fail to do it, generally speaking, the legal system will not order me to do it. That's the decree of specific performance, which is usually not available as a remedy, but it will simply make me pay money, called damages, for my failure to do it. If I promise to sell you potatoes and I don't deliver the potatoes, I will not be ordered to deliver potatoes. Rather, you will buy potatoes on the market and I will simply have to compensate you from the difference. Based on this, Justice Holmes stated the fairly amazing proposition that there is no legal duty to fulfill a contract. There is simply a choice of either doing the contract or paying damages. And if one wants to understand the nature of a legal duty, one must consider them as two equally valid alternatives. And to talk about a duty to keep a contract really makes no sense at all, because if the law will not enforce it, there cannot be said to be a legal duty. And this is the meaning of his statement, that one must view the law through the eyes of a bad man. Jewish law proceeds on the very opposite premise, that in Jewish law, the moral obligations are the obligations that a person must live by. Whether or not a court will enforce it might be of secondary importance to the fact that it is God's will that I live a certain way. And consequently, in Jewish law, it really makes no sense from a spiritual vantage point to talk about a legal obligation that is not a moral obligation, because moral obligations are in themselves obligatory, although it may very well be true that in certain instances, a human court, even a Jewish court, might not enforce it. Interestingly enough, in Leviticus chapter 19, there is a verse where God commands us to be holy, Kedoshim Tihiyu. And all of the biblical commentaries discuss what is the idea of being holy, what is it adding to the other 612 commandments. And Nachmanides, one of the great, great medieval commentators, offers this beautiful explanation that what Kedoshim Tihiyu is telling us is, it is not enough to follow the letter of the law. You must live by the spirit of the law. You must learn from those laws the traits of generosity, compassion, kindness, going beyond the letter of the law. And paradoxically, going beyond the letter of the law is one of the laws. One of the laws is thou shalt go beyond the letter of the law. And this is predicated on the notion of being a holy person. Kedoshim tiyu. There is another phrase that we often have. Lifnim mishurat hadin. You must go beyond the letter of the law. You must embody its spirit and not simply its letter. Alexandre de Tocqueville, the very famous French commentator, the astute author who described the American Republic in the early years of the United States, wrote in his book Democracy in America that Americans, even back in the 1790s, were an extraordinarily litigious people, that if somebody's fence was 1/16th of an inch over someone else's boundary line, he took them to court. And of course, all of us know that to this very day, the United States has more lawyers per capita than any other nation in the world. There is actually one lawyer per every 1,000 people in the United States. If you take a country like Japan, there is one lawyer for every 20,000 people. A little hint, by the way, if you're doing business in Japan, generally try to show up without a lawyer, because if you bring a lawyer, it's a sign of bad faith and an unwillingness to negotiate. And that is because in American society, law has been used to establish and vindicate rights. We are a very rights-oriented society. We wake up in the morning and we ask ourselves, what rights do I have against other people? How can I assert my rights? How can I vindicate my rights? That is the tradition of freedom and individualism that has really served our country very well. Jewish law, however, does not speak of rights. Jewish law primarily speaks of obligations and responsibilities. Now, to some degree, this is semantic. After all, if I have an obligation not to infringe on your property rights, that's the same thing as saying you have a right to be free of my interference. So it is true that rights and obligations are just opposite sides of the same coin. But there is a fundamental different way of viewing the world. If you view the world from the perspective of rights, the fundamental question you're asking yourself is, what does the world owe me? If you view your life through the prism and perspective of obligation, you wake up in the morning and you ask yourself, what can I give to the world? What can I do to show my obedience to God? So yes, rights and obligations correlate, but a rights orientation focuses on egotism and possessiveness and control and domination. And a function that focuses on obligation focuses on benevolence, compassion, giving, tolerance, and compromise. And I think it's been said many, many times, and it's a true statement, that Jewish law is much more concerned with obligations than it is with rights, because Jewish law is concerned with holiness and nobility of character, rather than simply securing private autonomy and control. The goal of secular law has been well said by the classic liberal theorist John Stuart Mill, that it is the realization of private autonomy. But the goal of Jewish law is the creation of a godly people and a God-fearing nation. And as a result, we focus on obligation rather than right. Let me give you two stories that I think illustrate this very beautifully. One is from the Talmud, and one is an anecdote involving a Mormon law professor at Brigham Young University. First, the anecdote from the Talmud. The Talmud, at the end of the sixth chapter of Bava Metzia, tells the story of Rabba Bar Bar Chana, who had hired workers to transport his wine. Those workers were careless and negligent, and as a result of their carelessness, the wine barrel smashed and the wine became useless. The wine simply drained into the ground. He sued the workers for compensation. They owed him the value of the wine because of their negligence. The only defense that the workers had was, we're poor, we can't afford to pay the judgment. The rabbi deciding the case decided in favor of the workers. Rabba Bar Bar Chana turned to the rabbi and said, is that the law? They're negligent. There ought to be a judgment against them. And the rabbi told him, for you, that's the law. If you want to be a godly person, you must learn to forgive and have compassion. But then there's a part two to the story. Not only did he not have to pay, not only did they not have to pay him, but as he was walking out of the room, they then said, wait a second, we have not been paid for our work. This is an early example of chutzpah, like the story of the person who kills his parents and then asks mercy from the court because he's an orphan, although we've actually seen that in California, in the Menendez case. But be it as it may, they said, you owe us money. And Rabbah was incredulous because he said, it's not enough that you don't have to pay me for the wine that you destroyed, but I have to pay you? And once again, their response was, yeah, we have families. And once again, the rabbi that was the judge said, yep, pay them. And when Rabbah said, is that the law? The rabbi said, for you, that's the law. Now let me emphasize, the commentaries explain that this was not a regular judicial proceeding. In a regular judicial proceeding, it would actually be immoral for a judge to side with the disadvantaged at the expense of the plaintiff with a meritorious claim. If the judge wants to give charity, let the judge write out the check. You don't give charity by injustice against a rightful claim. But rather, this was in the nature of an arbitration involving the spiritual mentor of the plaintiff. And the spiritual mentor or rabbi of the plaintiff is essentially telling him, learn how to forgive, learn how to compromise, adopt within your life the ethic of obligation rather than the ethic of rights. That's not to say that in a court proceeding, people are not entitled to have their rights vindicated, but as a general orientation, we focus much more on what are my responsibilities than what are my obligations.